Sailing Alone Around the World by Joshua Slocum, a Book of the Road production, read by David Booth. In the fair land of Nova Scotia, a maritime province, there is a ridge called North Mountain, overlooking the Bay of Fundy on one side and the fertile Annapolis Valley on the other. On the northern slope of the range grows the hardy spruce tree, well adapted for ship timbers, of which many vessels of all classes have been built. The people of this coast, hardy, robust, and strong, are disposed to compete in the world's commerce, and it is nothing against the master mariner if the birthplace mentioned on his certificate be Nova Scotia. I was born on a cold spot, on coldest North Mountain on a cold February 20, although I am a citizen of the United States, a naturalized Yankee, if it may be said that Nova Scotians are not Yankees in the truest sense of the word. On both sides, my family were sailors, and if any Slocum should be found not seafaring, he will show at least an inclination to whittle models of boats and contemplate voyages. My father was the sort of man who, if wrecked on a desolate island, would find his way home if he had a jackknife and could find a tree. As for myself, the wonderful sea charmed me from the first. At the age of 8, I had already been afloat along with other boys on the bay, with chances greatly in favor of being drowned. When a lad, I filled the important post of cook on a fishing schooner. But I was not long in the galley, for the crew mutinied at the appearance of my first duff and chucked me out before I had a chance to shine as a culinary artist. The next step toward the goal of happiness found me before the mast in a full-rigged ship bound on a foreign voyage. Thus I came over the bows, and not in through the cabin windows, to the command of a ship. My voyages were all foreign. I sailed as freighter and trader principally to China, Australia, and Japan, and among the Spice Islands. Mine was not the sort of life to make one long to coil up one's ropes on land, the customs and ways of which I'd finally almost forgotten. And so when times for freighters got bad, as at last they did, and I tried to quit the sea, what was there for an old sailor to do? I was born in the breezes, and I'd studied the sea as perhaps few men have studied it, neglecting all else. Next in attractiveness, after seafaring, came shipbuilding. I longed to be master in both professions, and in a small way in time, I accomplished my desire. From the decks of stout ships in the worst gales, I had made calculations as to the size and sort of ship safest for all weather and all seas. Thus, the voyage which I am now about to narrate was a natural outcome not only of my love of adventure, but of my lifelong experience. One midwinter day of 1892 in Boston, where I'd been cast up from old ocean, so to speak, a year or two before, I was cogitating whether I should apply for a command or go to work at the shipyard when I met an old acquaintance, a whaling captain, who said, "Come to Fairhaven and I'll give you a ship. But she wants some repairs." Now, the captain's terms, when fully explained, were more than satisfactory to me. They included all the assistance I would require to fit the craft for sea. I was only too glad to accept, for I'd already found that I could not obtain work in the shipyard without first paying $50 to a society, and as for a ship to command, there were not enough ships to go around. Nearly all our tall vessels had been cut down for coal barges, and were being ignominiously towed by the nose from port to port, while many worthy captains addressed themselves to sailors' snug harbor. The next day, I landed at Fairhaven, opposite New Bedford, and I found that my friend had something of a joke on me. For 7 years, the joke had been on him. The ship proved to be a very antiquated sloop called the Spray, which the neighbors declared had been built in the year one. She was affectionately propped up in a field some distance from salt water and was covered with canvas. The people of Fairhaven, I hardly need say, are thrifty and observant. For 7 years, they had asked, "I wonder what Captain Eben Pierce is going to do with the old Spray." The day I appeared, there was a buzz at the gossip exchange. At last, someone had come and was actually at work on the old Spray. "Breaking her up, I suppose?" "No, going to rebuild her." Great was the amazement. "Will it pay?" was the question, which for a year or more I answered by declaring that I would make it pay. My axe felled a stout oak tree nearby for a keel, and Farmer Howard, for a small sum of money, hauled in this and enough timbers for the frame of the new vessel. I rigged a steam box and a pot for a boiler. The timbers for ribs, being straight saplings, were dressed and steamed till supple, and then bent over a log, where they were secured till set. Something tangible appeared every day to show for my labor, and the neighbors made the work sociable. It was a great day in the Spray shipyard when her new stem was set up, fastened to the new keel. Whaling captains came from far to survey it. With one voice, they pronounced it A1, and their opinion, fit to smash ice. The much-esteemed stem piece was from the butt of the smartest kind of a pastor oak. It afterwards split a coral patch in two at the Keeling Islands and did not receive a blemish. All the ribs were of this wood and were steamed and bent into shape as required. It was hard upon March when I began work in earnest. The weather was cold. Still, there were plenty of inspectors to back me with advice. The seasons came quickly while I worked. Hardly were the ribs of the sloop up before apple trees were in bloom. Then the daisies and the cherries came soon after. Close by the place where the old spray had now dissolved rested the ashes of John Cook, a revered pilgrim father. So the new spray rose from hallowed ground. From the deck of the new craft, I could put out my hand and pick cherries that grew over the little grave. The planks for the new vessel, which I soon came to put on, were of Georgia pine, an inch and a half thick. The operation of putting them on was tedious, but it was my purpose to make my vessel stout and strong. Now, it is a law in Lloyd's that the Jane, repaired all out of the old until she's entirely new, is still the Jane. The spray changed her being so gradually that it was hard to say at what point the old died or the new took birth, and it was no matter. The bulwarks I built up of white oak stanchions 14 inches high and covered with 7/8-inch white pine. The deck I made of 1.5-inch by 3-inch white pine spiked to beams, 6 by 6 inches, of yellow or Georgia pine placed 3 feet apart. The deck enclosures were one over the aperture of the main hatch, 6 feet by 6 for a cooking galley, and a trunk further aft, about 10 feet by 12 for a cabin. Both of these rose about 3 feet above the deck and were sunk sufficiently into the hold to afford headroom. In the spaces along the sides of the cabin, under the deck, I arranged for a berth to sleep in, and shelves for small storage, not forgetting a place for the medicine chest. In the midship hold, that is, the space between the cabin and the galley, under the deck, was room for provisions of water, salt, beef, etc., ample for many months. When the caulking was finished, 2 coats of copper paint were slapped on the bottom, 2 of white lead on the top sides, and bulwarks. The rudder was then shipped and painted, and on the following day, the spray was launched. As she rode at her ancient, rust-eaten anchor, she sat on the water like a swan. The spray's dimensions were, when finished, 36 feet 9 inches long overall, 14 feet 2 inches wide, and 4 feet 2 inches deep in the hold, her tonnage being 9 tons net and 12 7/100 ton gross. Then the mast, a smart New Hampshire spruce, was fitted, and likewise all the small appurtenances necessary for a short cruise. Sails were bent, and away she flew with my friend Captain Pierce and me across Buzzard's Bay on a trial trip. All right. The only thing that now worried my friends along the beach was, will she pay? The cost of my new vessel was $553.62 for materials and 13 months of my own labor. I spent a season in my new craft fishing on the coast, only to find that I had not the cunning properly to bait a hook. But at last the time arrived to weigh anchor and get to sea in earnest. I'd resolved on a voyage around the world, and as the wind on the morning of April 24th, 1895 was fair, at noon I weighed anchor, set sail, and filled away from Boston, where the spray had been moored snugly all winter. The 12 o'clock whistles were blowing just as the sloop shot ahead under full sail. The photographer on the outer pier at East Boston got a picture of her as she swept by, her flag at the peak throwing its folds clear. A thrilling pulse beat high in me. My step was light on deck in the crisp air. I felt that there could be no turning back, and I was engaging in an adventure the meaning of which I thoroughly understood. I'd taken little advice from anyone, for I had a right to my own opinions in matters pertaining to the sea. The wind freshened, and the spray rounded Deer Island Light at 7 knots. Passing it, she squared away direct for Gloucester, where she was to procure some fishermen's stores. Waves dancing joyously across Massachusetts Bay met the sloop coming out, to dash themselves instantly into myriads of sparkling gems that hung about her at every surge. The day was perfect, the sunlight clear and strong. Every particle of water thrown into the air became a gem, and the spray, making good her name as she dashed ahead, snatched necklace after necklace from the sea, and as often threw them away. We've all seen miniature rainbows about a ship's prow, but the spray flung out a bow of her own that day such as I'd never seen before. A good angel had embarked on the voyage. I so read it in the sea. Bold Nahant was soon abeam, then Marblehead was put astern. Other vessels were outward bound, but none of them passed the spray flying along in her course. I heard the clanking of the dismal bell on Norman's Woe as we went by, and the reef where the schooner Hesperus struck, I passed close aboard. The bones of a wreck tossed up lay bleaching on the shore. I made for the cove, a lovely branch of Gloucester's fine harbor, again to look the spray over and again to weigh the voyage and my feelings and all that. The bay was feather white as my little vessel tore in, smothered in foam. It was my first experience of coming into port alone with a craft of any size, and in among shipping. Old fishermen ran down to the wharf for which the spray was heading, apparently intent upon braining herself there. I hardly know how a calamity was averted, but with my heart in my mouth, almost, I let go the wheel, stepped quickly forward, and down the jib. The sloop naturally rounded into the wind, and just ranging ahead, laid her cheek against a mooring pile at the windward corner of the wharf, so quietly, after all, that she would have not broken an egg. Very leisurely, I passed a rope around the post, and she was moored. Then a cheer went up from the little crowd on the wharf. "You couldn't have done it better," cried an old skipper, "if you'd weighed a ton." Now, my weight was rather less than the 15th part of a ton, but I said nothing, only putting on a look of careless indifference to say for me, "Oh, that's nothing," for some of the ablest sailors in the world were looking at me, and my wish was not to appear green, for I had a mind to stay in Gloucester several days. Had I uttered a word, it surely would have betrayed me, for I was still quite nervous and short of breath. I remained in Gloucester about 2 weeks, fitting out with the various articles for the voyage. The owners of the wharf where I lay, and of many fishing vessels, put on board dry cod galore, also a barrel of oil to calm the waves. They were old skippers themselves and took a great interest in the voyage. They also made the spray a present of a fisherman's own lantern, which I found would throw a light a great distance round. Indeed, a ship that would run another down, having such a good light aboard, would be capable of running into a light ship. A gaff and a dip net, all of which an old fisherman declared I could not sail without, were also put aboard. Then, too, from across the cove came a case of copper paint, a famous antifouling article, which stood me in good stead long after. I slapped 2 coats of this paint on the bottom of the spray while she lay a tide or so on the hard beach. For a boat to take along, I made shift to cut a castaway dory in 2 athwartships, boarding up the end where it was cut. This half dory I could hoist in and out by the nose easily enough, by hooking the halyards into a strop fitted for the purpose. A whole dory would be heavy and awkward to handle alone. Manifestly, there was not room on deck for more than the half of a boat, which, after all, was better than no boat at all, and was large enough for one man. I perceived, moreover, that the newly arranged craft would answer for a washing machine when placed athwartships, and also for a bathtub. Indeed, for the former office, my dory gained such a reputation on the voyage that my washerwoman at Samoa would not take no for an answer. She could see with one eye that it was a new invention which beat any Yankee notion ever brought by missionaries to the islands, and she had to have it. Now, the want of a chronometer for the voyage was all that now worried me. In our newfangled notions of navigation, it is supposed that a mariner cannot find his way without one, and I had myself drifted into this way of thinking. My old chronometer, a good one, had long been in disuse. It would cost $15 to clean and rate it. $15! For sufficient reasons, I left that timepiece at home. I had the great lantern, and a lady in Boston sent me the price of a large 2-burner cabin lamp, which lighted the cabin at night, and by some small contriving served for a stove throughout the day. Being thus refitted, I was once more ready for sea, and on May 7, again made sail. The sloop worked out of the bay against a light southwest wind, and about noon squared away off Eastern Point, receiving at the same time a hearty salute, the last of many kindnesses to her at Gloucester. The wind freshened off the point, and skipping along smoothly, the spray was soon off Thatcher's Island Lights, thence shaping her course east by compass to go north of Cassius Ledge and the Amen Rocks. Toward night, I hauled the sloop to the wind and, baiting a hook, sounded for bottom fish in 30 fathoms of water on the edge of Cassius Ledge. With fair success, I hauled till dark, landing on deck 3 cod and 2 haddocks, 1 hake, and best of all, a small halibut, all plump and spry. This, I thought, would be the place to take in a good stock of provisions above what I already had, so I put out a sea anchor that would hold her head to windward. The current being southwest against the wind, I felt sure I would find the spray still on the bank or near it in the morning. Then, putting my great lantern in the rigging, I lay down, for the first time at sea alone, not to sleep, but to doze and dream. I had read somewhere of a fishing schooner hooking her anchor into a whale and being towed a long way and at a great speed. This was exactly what happened to the Spray in my dream. I could not shake it off entirely when I awoke and found that it was the wind blowing and the heavy sea now running that had disturbed my short rest. A scud was flying across the moon. A storm was brewing. I reefed the sails, then hauled in my sea anchor, and setting what canvas the sloop could carry, headed her away for the Monaghan Light, which she made before daylight on the morning of the 8th. The wind being free, I ran on into Round Pond Harbor, which is a little port east from Pemaquid. Here I rested a day, while the wind rattled among the pine trees on shore. But the following day was fine enough, and I put to sea, first writing up my log from Cape Ann, not omitting a full account of my adventure with the whale. The Spray, heading east, stretched along the coast among many islands and over a tranquil sea. At evening of this day, May 10, she came up with a considerable island, which I shall always think of as the Island of Frogs, for the Spray was charmed by a million voices. From the Island of Frogs, we made for the Island of Birds, called Gannet Island. Then, shaping a course for Briar's Island, I came along vessels the following afternoon on the western fishing grounds, and after speaking a fisherman at anchor, who gave me a wrong course, the Spray sailed directly over the southwest ledge through the worst tide race in the Bay of Fundy and got into Westport Harbor in Nova Scotia, where I'd spent 8 years of my life as a lad. At Briar's Island, I overhauled the Spray once more and tried her seams, but found that even the test of the southwest rip had started nothing. Then I sailed, putting into Yarmouth the following day on account of fog and headwind. I spent some days pleasantly enough in Yarmouth, took in some butter for the voyage, also a barrel of potatoes, filled 6 barrels with water, and stowed all under deck. At Yarmouth, too, I got my famous 10 o'clock, the only timepiece I carried on the whole voyage. Price of it was $1.50, but on account of the face being smashed, the merchant let me have it for $1. I now stowed all my goods securely, for the boisterous Atlantic was before me, and I sent the topmast down, knowing that the Spray would be the wholesomer with it on deck. Then I gave the lanyards a pull and hitched them afresh, and saw also that the boat was lashed, for even in summer one may meet with bad weather in crossing. In fact, many weeks of bad weather had prevailed. On July 1st, however, after a rude gale, the wind came out of northwest and clear, propitious for a good run. On the following day, I sailed from Yarmouth and let go my last hold on America. The log of my first day on the Atlantic and the Spray reads briefly. 9:30 a.m., sailed from Yarmouth. 4:30 p.m., past Cape Sable. The sloop making 8 knots. Fresh breeze, northwest. Before the sun went down, I was taking my supper of strawberries and tea in smooth water under the lee of the East Coast land, along which the Spray was now leisurely skirting. At noon on July 3rd, Ironbound Island was abeam. The Spray was again at her best. A large schooner came out of Liverpool, Nova Scotia, this morning steering eastward. The Spray put her hull down astern in 5 hours. At 6:45 p.m., I was near Halifax Harbor. I set my flag and squared away, taking my departure from George's Island before dark, to sail east to Sable Island. There are many beacon lights along the coast. Sambro, the Rock of Lamentations, carries a noble light, which, however, the liner Atlantic, on the night of her terrible disaster, did not see. I watched light after light sink astern as I sailed into the unbounded sea, till Sambro, the last of them all, was below the horizon. The Spray was then alone, and sailing on, she held her course. On the evening of July 5th, the Spray, after having steered all day over a lumpy sea, took it into her head to go without the helmsman's aid. I'd been steering southeast by south, but the wind hauling forward a bit, she dropped into a smooth lane heading southeast and making about 8 knots, her very best work. I crowded on sail to cross the track of the liners without loss of time and to reach as soon as possible the friendly Gulf Stream. The fog lifting before night, I was afforded a look at the sun just as it was touching the sea. I watched it go down and out of sight. Then I turned my face eastward, and there, apparently at the very end of the bowsprit, was a smiling full moon rising out of the sea. Neptune himself coming over the bows could not have startled me more. "Good evening, sir," I cried. "I'm glad to see you." Many a long talk since then I've had with the man on the moon, and he had my confidence on the voyage. About midnight, the fog shut down again denser than ever before. One could almost stand on it.
It continued so for a number of days, the wind increasing to a gale. The waves rose high, but I had a good ship. Still, in the dismal fog, I felt myself drifting into loneliness. I lashed the helm, and my vessel held her course, and while she sailed, I slept. During these days, a feeling of awe crept over me. My memory worked with startling power. The ominous, the insignificant, the great, the small, the wonderful, the commonplace, all appeared before my mental vision in magical succession. Pages of my history were recalled, which had been so long forgotten that they seemed to belong to a previous existence. I heard all the voices of the past, laughing, crying, telling what I had heard them tell in many corners of the earth. The loneliness of my state wore off when the gale was high and I found much work to do. When fine weather returned, then came the sense of solitude, which I could not shake off. However, it was not long before the thought came to me that when I was a lad, I used to sing. Why not try that now, where it would disturb no one? My musical talent had never bred envy in others. But out on the Atlantic, to realize what it meant, you should have heard me sing. You should have seen the porpoises leap when I pitched my voice for the waves and the sea and all that was in it. Old turtles with large eyes poked their heads up out of the sea as I sang. But the porpoises were, on the whole, vastly more appreciative than the turtles. They jumped a deal higher. One day when I was humming a favorite chant, I think it was Babylon's a Fallen, a porpoise jumped higher than the bowsprit. Had the spray been going a little faster, she would have scooped him in. July 10, 8 days at sea, the spray was 1,200 miles east of Cape Sable. 150 miles a day for so small a vessel must be considered good sailing. It was the greatest run the spray had ever made before or since in so few days. There was now less and less monotony. On July 16, the wind was northwest and clear. The sea smooth and a large bark, hull down, came in sight on the lee bow. And at 2:30 p.m., I spoke to the stranger. She was the bark Java of Glasgow, from Peru for Queenstown for orders. Her old captain was bearish. I suppose my hail disturbed his siesta, and my little sloop passing his great ship had somewhat the effect on him that a red rag has upon a bull. I had the advantage over heavy ships by long odds in the light winds of this and the two previous days. The wind was light, and his ship was heavy, and making poor headway, while the spray, with a great mainsail bellying even to light winds, was just skipping along as nimbly as one could wish. "How long has it been calm about here?" roared the captain of the Java, as I came within hail of him. "Dunno, captain," I shouted back as loud as I could bawl. "I haven't been here long." At this, the mate on the forecastle wore a broad grin. "I left Cape Sable 14 days ago," I added. I was now well across toward the Azores. "Mate," he roared to his chief officer, "mate, come here and listen to the Yankee's yarn. Haul down the flag, mate, haul down the flag." In the best of humor, after all, the Java surrendered to the spray. The acute pain of solitude experienced at first never returned. I'd penetrated a mystery, and by the way, I'd sailed through a fog. I'd met Neptune in his wrath, but he found that I had not treated him with contempt, and so he suffered me to go on and explore. Land ho! On the morning of July 19, a mystic dome like a mountain of silver stood alone in the sea ahead. Although the land was completely hidden by the white, glistening haze that shone in the sun like polished silver, I felt quite sure that it was Flores Island. At 4:30 p.m., it was abeam. The haze in the meantime had disappeared. Flores is 174 miles from Fayal, and although it is a high island, it remained many years undiscovered after the principal group of the islands had been colonized. Early in the morning of July 20th, I saw Pico looming above the clouds on the starboard bow. Lower lands burst forth as the sun burned away the morning fog, and island after island came into view. As I approached near, cultivated fields appeared, and oh, how green the corn! Only those who have seen the Azores from the deck of a vessel realize the beauty of this mid-ocean picture. At 4:30 p.m., I cast anchor at Fayal, exactly 18 days from Cape Sable. The American consul, in a smart boat, came alongside before the spray reached the breakwater, and a young naval officer who feared for the safety of my vessel boarded and offered me his services as a pilot. The youngster, I have no good reason to doubt, could have handled a man of war, but the spray was too small for the amount of uniform he wore. However, after fouling all the craft in port and sinking a lighter, She was moored without much damage to herself. It was the season for fruit when I arrived at the Azores, and there was soon more of all kinds of it put on board than I knew what to do with. Islanders are always the kindest people in the world, and I met none anywhere kinder than the good hearts of this place. I remained 4 days at Fayal, and that was 2 more days than I'd intended to stay. It was the kindness of the islanders and their touching simplicity which detained me. I set sail from Horta early on July 24th. Southwest wind at the time was light, but squalls came up with the sun, and I was glad enough to get reefs in my sails before I'd gone a mile. I'd hardly set the mainsail, double-reefed, when a squall of wind down the mountain struck the sloop with such violence that I thought her mast would go. However, a quick helm brought her into the wind. As it was, one of the weather lanyards was carried away and the other was stranded. My tin basin, caught up by the wind, went flying across a French schoolship to leeward. It was more or less squally all day, sailing along under the high land. But rounding close under a bluff, I found an opportunity to mend the lanyards broken in the squall. Since reaching the islands, I've lived most luxuriously on fresh bread, butter, vegetables, and fruits of all kinds. Plums seemed the most plentiful on the Spray, and these I ate without stint. I also had a pico white cheese that the American Consulate General had given me, which I suppose was to be eaten, and of this I partook with the plums. Alas, by the night time I was doubled up with the cramps. The wind, which was already a smart breeze, was increasing somewhat with a heavy sky to the southwest. Between cramps, I got the mainsail down, hauled out the earrings as best I could, and tied away point by point in the double reef. There being sea room, I should, in strict prudence, have made all snug and gone down at once to my cabin. I'm a careful man at sea, but this night, in the coming storm, I swayed up my sails, which, reefed though they were still too much in such heavy weather, and I saw to it that the sheets were securely belayed. In a word, I should have laid to, but I did not. I gave her the double reef mainsail and the whole jib instead and set her on her course. Then I went below and threw myself on the cabin floor in great pain. How long I lay there I could not tell, for I became delirious. When I came to, I realized that the sloop was plunging into a heavy sea, and looking out of the companionway, to my amazement I saw a tall man at the helm. His rigid hand, grasping the spokes of the wheel, held them as in a vice. One may imagine my astonishment. His rig was that of a foreign sailor, and the large red cap he wore was cock-billed over his left ear, and all was set off with shaggy black whiskers. He would have been taken for a pirate in any part of the world. While I gazed upon his threatening aspect, I forgot the storm, and I wondered if he had come to cut my throat. This he seemed to divine.
"Señor," said he, doffing his cap, "I have come to do you no harm."
And a smile, the faintest in the world, but still a smile, played on his face, which seemed not unkind when he spoke.
"I have come to do you no harm. I have sailed free, but was never worse than a contrabandista. I am one of Columbus' crew. I am the pilot of the Pinta, come to aid you. Lie quiet, Señor Captain, and I will guide your ship tonight. You have a calentura, but you will be all right tomorrow."
I thought what a very devil he was to carry sail. Again, as if he read my mind, he exclaimed,
"Yonder is the Pinta ahead. We must overtake her. Give her sail. Give her sail. Vale, vale, muy vale."
Biting off a large quid, a black twist, he said,
"You did wrong, Captain, to mix cheese with plums. White cheese is never safe unless you know whence it comes. Quien sabe? It may have been from leche de capra and becoming capricious."
"Avast there," I cried, "I've no mind for moralizing." I made shift to spread a mattress and lie on that instead of the hard floor, my eyes all the while fastened on my strange guest, who, remarking again that I would have only pens and calentura, I suppose I was now on the mend, for I was peevish, and I was still in agony. Great seas were boarding the Spray, but in my fevered brain, I thought there were boats falling on deck, that careless draymen were throwing from wagons on the pier, to which I imagined the Spray was now moored, and without fenders to breast her off. "You'll smash your boats," I called out again and again as the seas crashed on the cabin over my head. "You'll smash your boats, but you can't hurt the Spray. She's strong." I found, when my pains and calentura had gone, that the deck, now as white as a shark's tooth from seas washing over it, had been swept of everything movable. To my astonishment, I saw now at broad day that the spray was still heading as I had left her and was going like a racehorse. Columbus himself could have not held her more exactly on her course. The sloop had made 90 miles in the night through a rough sea. I felt grateful to the old pilot, but I marveled some that he'd not taken in the jib. The gale was moderating, and by noon the sun was shining. A meridian altitude and the distance on the patent log, which I always kept towing, told me that she had made a true course throughout the 24 hours. I was getting much better now, but was very weak, and did not turn out reefs that day or the night following, although the wind fell light. But I just put my wet clothes out in the sun when it was shining, and lying down there myself, fell asleep. Then who should visit me again but my old friend of the night before? This time, of course, in a dream. You did well last night to take my advice. And if you would, I should like to be with you often on the voyage, for the love of adventure alone. Finishing what he had to say, he again doffed his cap and disappeared as mysteriously as he came, returning, I suppose, to the Phantom Pinta. I woke much refreshed, and with the feeling that I'd been in the presence of a friend and seaman of vast experience. I gathered up my clothes, which by this time were dry. Then, by inspiration, I threw overboard all the plums in the vessel. July 28th was exceptionally fine. The wind from the northwest was light and the air balmy. I overhauled my wardrobe and bent on a white shirt against nearing some coasting packet with genteel folk on board. I also did some washing to get the salt out of my clothes. After it all, I was hungry, so I made a fire and very cautiously stewed a dish of pears and set them carefully aside till I had made a pot of delicious coffee, for both of which I could afford sugar and cream. But the crowning dish of all was a fish hash, and there was enough of it for two. I was in good health again. My appetite was simply ravenous. While I was dining, I had a large onion over the double lamp stewing for a luncheon later in the day. High living today. In the afternoon, the spray came upon a large turtle asleep on the sea. He awoke with my harpoon through his neck, if he awoke at all. I had much difficulty in landing him on deck, which I finally accomplished by hooking the lanyards to one of his flippers, for he was about as heavy as my boat. But the turtle steak was good. I found no fault with the cook, and it was the rule of the voyage that the cook found no fault with me. There was never a ship's crew so well agreed. The bill of fare that evening was turtle steak, tea and toast, fried potatoes, stewed onions, with dessert of stewed pears and cream. Sometime in the afternoon, I passed a barrel boy adrift, floating light on the water. A sudden change in the weather coming on, I got no more turtle or fish of any sort before reaching port. July 31st, a gale sprang up suddenly from the north with heavy seas and a shortened sail. The spray made only 51 miles on her course that day. August 1st, the gale continued with heavy seas. On August 3rd, the gale broke, and I saw many signs of land. Bad weather having made itself felt in the galley, I was minded to try my hand at a loaf of bread, and so, rigging a pot of fire on deck by which to bake it, a loaf soon became an accomplished fact. One great feature about ship's cooking is that one's appetite on the sea is always good. Dinner being over, I sat for hours reading The Life of Columbus. And as the day wore on, I watched the birds all flying in one direction and said, "Land lies there." Early the next morning, August 4th, I discovered Spain. The spray passed through the Strait of Gibraltar, where she cast anchor the same day, less than 29 days from Cape Sable. So far as I know, the spray beat everything going across the Atlantic, except the steamers. All was well, but I'd forgotten to bring a bill of health from Horta, so when the fierce old port doctor came to inspect, there was a row. That, however, was the very thing needed. If you want to get on well with a true Britisher, you must first have a deuce of a row with him. I knew that well enough, and so I fired away, shot for shot, as best I could. "Well, yes," the doctor admitted at last, "your crew were healthy enough, no doubt, but who knows the diseases of your last port?" A reasonable enough remark. "We ought to put you in the fort, sir," he blustered. "But never mind, shove off." And that was the last I saw of the port doctor. That one should like Gibraltar would go without saying. Vegetables twice a week and milk every morning came from the palatial grounds of the Admiralty. I rambled much about the old city, and a gunner piloted me through the galleries of the rock as far as a stranger is permitted to go. There is no excavation in the world for military purposes at all approaching these of Gibraltar in conception or execution. Before sailing, I was invited on a picnic with the governor, the officers of the garrison, and the commanders of the warships. And a royal affair it was. At each place and all about, I felt the friendly grasp of a manly hand that lent me vital strength to pass the coming long days at sea. Monday, August 25th, the Spray sailed from Gibraltar. Well repaid for whatever deviation she'd made from a direct course to reach the place. A tug belonging to Her Majesty towed the sloop into the steady breeze clear of the mount, where her sails caught a volant wind, which carried her once more to the Atlantic, where it rose rapidly to a furious gale. My plan was, in going down this coast, to haul offshore well clear of the land, which hereabouts is the home of pirates. But I had hardly accomplished this when I perceived a felucca making out of the nearest port and finally following in the wake of the Spray. Now, my course to Gibraltar had been taken with a view to proceed up the Mediterranean Sea, through the Suez Canal, down the Red Sea, and east about, instead of a western route, which I finally adopted. By officers of vast experiences in navigating these seas, I was influenced to make the change. Longshore pirates on both coasts being numerous, I could not afford to make light of the advice. But here I was, after all, evidently in the midst of pirates and thieves. I changed my course. The felucca did the same, both vessels sailing very fast, but the distance growing less and less between us. The Spray was doing nobly. She was even more than at her best. But in spite of all I could do, she would broach now and then. She was carrying too much sail for safety. I must reef or be dismasted and lose all, pirate or no pirate. I was not long in reefing the mainsail, probably not more than 15 minutes. But the felucca had in the meantime so shortened the distance between us that I now saw the tuft of hair on the heads of the crew, by which it is said, Muhammad will pull the villains up into heaven. And they were coming on like the wind. From what I could clearly make out now, I felt them to be the sons of generations of pirates, and I saw by their movements that they were now prepared to strike a blow. The exultation in their faces, however, was changed in an instant to a look of fear and rage. Their craft, with too much sail on, broached to on the crest of a great wave. 3 minutes later, the same wave overtook the Spray and shook her in every timber. At the same moment, the sheets dropped parted, and away went the main boom, broken short at the rigging. Impulsively, I sprang to the jib halyards and downhaul and instantly down the jib. The headsail being off and the helm being put hard down, the sloop came in the wind without a bound. While shivering there, but a moment though it was, I got the mainsail down and secured inboard, broken boom and all. How I got the boom in before the sail was torn, I hardly know. But not a stitch of it was broken. The mainsail being secured, I hoisted away the jib and, without looking round, stepped quickly to the cabin and snatched my loaded rifle and cartridges at hand, for I made mental calculations that the pirate would by this time have recovered his course and be close aboard, and that when I saw him, it would be better for me to be looking at him along the barrel of a gun. The piece was at my shoulder when I peered into the mist, but there was no pirate within a mile. The wave and squall that carried away my boom dismasted the felucca outright. I perceived his thieving crew, some dozen or more of them, struggling to recover their rigging from the sea. Allah blacken their faces. By the time I had things in order, it was dark, and a flying fish had already fallen on deck. I took him below for my supper, but found myself too tired to cook or even to eat a thing already prepared. I do not remember to have been more tired before or since in all my life than I was at the finish of that day. Too fatigued to sleep, I rolled about with the motion of the vessel till near midnight, when I made shift to dress my fish and prepare a dish of tea. I fully realized now, if I had not before, that the voyage ahead would call for exertions ardent and lasting. On August 27th, nothing could be seen of the moor or his country either, except two peaks, away in the east through the clear atmosphere of morning. Soon after the sun rose, even these were obscured by haze, much to my satisfaction. The wind, for a few days following my escape from the pirates, blew a steady but moderate gale, and the sea, though agitated into long rollers, was not uncomfortably rough or dangerous. and while sitting in my cabin, I could hardly realize that any sea was running at all. So easy was the long, swinging motion of the sloop over the waves. All distracting uneasiness and excitement being now over, I was once more alone with myself in the realization that I was on the mighty sea and in the hands of the elements. But I was happy, and I was becoming more and more interested in the voyage. After 3 days of squalls and shifting winds, I threw myself down to rest and sleep, while, with helm lashed, the sloop sailed steadily on her course. September 1st, in the early morning, land clouds rising ahead told of the Canary Islands not far away. A change in the weather came next day. Storm clouds stretched their arms across the sky. To all appearances, or from the south, might come the fierce hurricane. Every point of the compass threatened a wild storm. My attention was turned to reefing sails, and no time was to be lost over it, for the sea in a moment was confusion itself. I was now scudding her for the channel between Africa and the easternmost of the Canary Islands, for which I was on the lookout. At 2 p.m., the weather suddenly becoming fine, the island stood in view, already abeam to starboard, and not more than 7 miles off. The wind freshened in the night, and the spray had a fine run through the channel. By daylight, September 3rd, she was 25 miles clear of all the islands, when a calm ensued, which was the precursor of another gale of wind that soon came on, bringing with it dust from the African shore. It howled dismally while it lasted, and the sea, in the course of an hour, was discolored with a reddish-brown dust. The air remained thick with flying dust all the afternoon, but the wind, veering northwest at night, swept it back to land and afforded the spray once more a clear sky. Her mast now bent under a strong, steady pressure, and her bellying sail swept the sea as she rolled scuppers under, curtsying to the waves. These rolling waves thrilled me as they tossed my ship, passing quickly under her keel. This was grand sailing. September 4th, the wind, still fresh, blew from the north-northeast, and the sea surged along with the sloop. The spray had now settled down to the trade winds and to the business of her voyage. On September 10, the spray passed the island of San Antonio, the northwesternmost of the Cape Verdes, close aboard. The landfall was wonderfully true, considering that no observations for longitude had been made. Then, leaving the Cape Verde Islands out of sight astern, I found myself once more sailing a lonely sea and in a solitude supreme all around. When I slept, I dreamed that I was alone. This feeling never left me, but sleeping or waking, I seemed always to know the position of the sloop, and I saw my vessel moving across the chart, which became a picture before me. One night, while I sat in the cabin under this spell, the profound stillness all about was broken by human voices alongside. I sprang instantly to the deck, startled beyond my power to tell. Passing close under lee, like an apparition, was a white bark under full sail. The sailors on board of her were hauling on ropes to brace the yards, which just cleared the sloop's mast as she swept by. No one hailed from the white-winged flyer, but I heard someone on board say that he saw lights on the sloop and that he made her out to be a fisherman. I sat long on the starlit deck that night, thinking of ships and watching the constellations on their voyage. The sloop was now rapidly drawing toward the region of doldrums, and the force of the trade winds was lessening. I could see by the ripples that a countercurrent had set in. September 14, a lofty three-masted ship heading north was seen from the masthead. On the following day, heavy rain clouds rose in the south, obscuring the sun. This was ominous of the doldrums. On the 16th, the spray entered this gloomy region to battle with squalls and to be harassed by fitful calms, for this is the state of the elements between the northeast and the southeast trades, where each wind, struggling in turn for mastery, expends its force whirling about in all directions. Making this still more trying to one's nerve and patience, the sea was tossed into confused cross lumps and fretted by eddying currents. As if something more were needed to complete a sailor's discomfort in this state, the rain poured down in torrents day and night. The spray struggled and tossed for 10 days, making only 300 miles on her course in all that time. Along the equatorial limit of the southeast trade winds, the air was heavily charged with electricity, and there was much thunder and lightning. It was hereabout I remembered that, a few years before, the American ship Alert was destroyed by lightning, Her people, by wonderful good fortune, were rescued. On September 25th, I sighted the ship North Star of London. The great ship was out 48 days from Norfolk, Virginia, and was bound for Rio, where we met again about 2 months later. The Spray was now 30 days from Gibraltar. The Spray's next companion of the voyage was a swordfish that swam alongside, showing its tall fin out of the water, till I made a stir for my harpoon, when it hauled its black flag down and disappeared. September 30th, at 11:30 in the morning, the Spray crossed the equator in longitude 29 degrees, 30 minutes west. At noon, she was 2 miles south of the line. The southeast trade winds gave her sails now a stiff full, sending her handsomely over the sea toward the coast of Brazil, where on October 5th, just north of Olinda Point, without further incident, she made the land, casting anchor in Pernambuco Harbor about noon, 40 days from Gibraltar and all well on board. Did I tire of the voyage in all that time? Not a bit of it. I was never in better trim in all my life, and I was eager for the more perilous experience of rounding the horn.